This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, as 900,000 public sector workers were forced on strike in South Africa, we talked to General Secretary Vavi of the Congress of South African Trade Unions on labor solidarity in South Africa and around the world. But first, we'll ask Molly Ivins, who let the dogs in? We're talking with the Texas-based columnist, author of Bushwhacked and Who Let the Dogs In, who's been covering Bush Jr. and Company since he was a shrub. She dissects the dirty deals by which they lie, cheat, steal, and kill, blasting away at the flim-flam with her biting humor. And welcome to...
Well, gosh darn, hell, nice to be speaking to a blue state audience.
All right.
Let's hope so anyway. It seems to be when New Jersey began to be violet, I was gravely concerned.
I've been greatly concerned before that, and you've been before that, I'm sure.
Well, Molly, I spent the weekend reading Who Let the Dogs In? Who did let the dogs in? How have we wound up in this horrible dilemma?
Well, I'm afraid, ultimately, the blame falls on all of us. We elected these people. As I don't really blame the people. Of course, I blame the media, one of my favorite villains, and goats. But I do think that we let the democratic system pretty much slide toward desuetude. Now, there's a word you don't often hear.
Were you laughing just at the word, the democratic system? Is it in quotes? Is it?
No. I'm actually very optimistic about democracy, and I think it will work. I think we can fix the system. I think our system of democracy is definitely broke and needs to be fixed. But I don't think it's that difficult, and I don't think it's that mysterious. And furthermore, I'm fairly optimistic about the possibilities of fixing it. Basically, what we have is a perfectly good system that's been corrupted by money, which, as all of you know who read history, that certainly would not be the first time that had happened. It's not that money in American politics has ever been unimportant, but it has now assumed an importance, such an overweening, overwhelming importance, that nothing else counts, relatively speaking. Of course, most of the money comes from corporate special interests. So what we've got here is something close to a corporate oligarchy, you know, ruled by the corporate rich. They're literally buying legislation through Congress by means of what is a system of legalized bribery. Campaign contributions are, you know, paying for legislation. It's pretty gross. But it can be fixed. It has been fixed in certain places, and no reason to get discouraged. And then people always say to me, when I say, well, public campaign financing is the answer, they say, well, you know, the money will figure out a way around that. Well, yeah, it probably will, and I see no reason to get discouraged by that. When that happens, we'll just fix it again. I'm a great believer in perpetual reform.
Molly, you've been covering our great president since before he was a great president, since he was a not-so-great governor, and before that he was with Harkin Energy.
Well,
why do we keep on reelecting this guy?
Yeah, I have to tell you somebody
we
who
haven't
is
elected him the first time, Ken, and I'm not so sure about this time.
Opposed. Well, to what George W. Bush has done as president. He's not stupid, he's not mean, and he's real limited. His record is so awful, in my opinion. But the truth is, as a human being, he probably should be cut some slack. He's doing the best he can. He's doing what he thinks is right. And I know that's sad. I know that's kind of pitiful, because he doesn't know very much. Kind of reminds me of almost everybody I ever had dinner with at Midland, Texas Petroleum Club. You come away thinking, gosh darn, what a swell bunch of fellas. Thank God they're not running the world.
But this guy is, and
exactly.
I mean, he seemed, from what you've written about and others, he seems to have made a mess in Texas, and they voted him for the presidency. And it looks as if he's got a good chance of being reelected for the presidency now, and he's made a mess again.
Well, yes, indeed. I would certainly agree with that. Now, you understand his reelection in Texas was not much of a deal. The governor of Texas actually doesn't have much power. We have constitutionally down here in Texas what's called the weak governor system. And as you know, in Texas, we always like to be number one. And I should point out that we have the weakest governor system of them all. And a lot of people voted for Bush under the impression that he had been running a large state for several years and must have some idea what he was doing. And unfortunately, not necessarily so. In addition to having had no power down here, the few very faint footprints you can see that he left on this state are all discouraging. And when I wrote a book about him, Shrub, Little Bush, I really did try, honestly, to describe his record, and without fear of favor, as it were, and what does Fox News say? We report, you decide. I just don't know. Well, we really tried hard to be fair to the guy. And as it turned out, I wound up giving him credit for something I shouldn't have given him credit for, which was an educational record here in Texas, which, as he has proved at the national level, totally dysfunctional law, which is the idea that, ooh, let's make the schools accountable. And we all thought it had worked in Texas, and it turned out to be a fraud. It turned out the schools were faking the figures. I don't blame that on Bush, but boy, did we misreport the idea that he had a good record on education. Sorry about that, people.
You know, we're still recuperating in New York from the Republican National Convention onslaught and its legacy. We're still trying to get those bicycles back that were expropriated, those dangerous bicycles. What about the scripting of the RNC? Now, you are a columnist, you're a Politico, you're a humorist. How do you look at and how do you understand an event like the Republican National Convention on the political system of this country?
Well, of course, I thought it was hysterically funny. Sit there and say, oh, I can't believe it. It's like, the material droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven. How could you possibly ask for anything more? And then, of course, it gets even more absurd and more bizarre and more surreal. And there you are going, oh, look, all this fabulous material. And then you look around and you notice that a whole lot of your fellow citizens are not laughing. They're actually taking this seriously. And you kind of go, oops, this could be a problem. I must say, and I am a great believer in giving credit where credit is due in politics. I thought the Republican National Convention was a damn good show. I thought it did exactly what they wanted it to do. Everybody was on message. You know, they hid the embarrassments in the closet. You didn't see John Ashcroft or...
I don't know. Yeah, they had Arnold Schwarzenegger out there. I mean, girly boy was enough to do it to me.
Well, there you are. I thought it was a well-scripted convention. What has absolutely dumbfounded me is that, and I've known Karl Rove for a long time, and I've known him to do this before, but I got to really amazed me that they actually had, as you say in New York, the noive, the chutzpah, to go after John Kerry on his. I mean, the guy's a hero. He's a military hero. No, there is no question about that. There's never been any question about that. If you don't like the rest of him, fine. Just give him that. But that was exactly the point they went after him on. And yes, everybody's exposed the fact that it was all a vile Republican plot and they were working with Rove and blah, 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 blah. Listen, what Rove knows is that you just keep lobbing the mud out there and some of it will stick.
Molly, maybe it's different in Texas, but there's all these reports about Ohio and Kansas that people who are unemployed, who became unemployed on Bush's watch because of the slow job growth, especially in the Midwest, are planning to vote for Bush. What do you make of that?
That really doesn't surprise me. I think we often see in this country a kind of politics that is like the old shell game at the carnivals. It's like your three-card money in New York. It's a game of misdirection where unless you keep your eye on the shell with the P under it, you're going to wind up losing and have to pay money. And I think the Republicans and this administration are particularly skilled at misdirecting attention so that we miss the shell with the P under it. And as my theory is that those people in Ohio and Kansas are conned. They're suckers. Bush has just chunked their overtime, which they don't even know about yet. It's in the classic American role, you know, idea that, you know, you go to the carny and they're going to rip you off. You're too much of a rube. You're too believing. You're too trusting. And part of the way they've always done this, and when I say they, I mean vaguely, loosely, whatever the establishment is, this goes back to the populist movement in the 19th century. You go back to the 1880s, 1890s, what you'll see is that probably the most democratic movement in the history of this country, the populist movement, it was farmers and it was urban workers, it was blacks, it was white, it was men, it was women, it was really ahead of its time. And you know how they broke that one up? Race. They split them into black and white. And it stuck for a long, long time. And now what they're doing is, loosely speaking, family value. There was actually, the Republican National Committee actually sent out a mailer to West Virginia Republicans last week saying that if you don't vote for Bush, the other people are going to ban the Bible. Now, here's a picture of the Bible with the big word banned stamped across it. Now, you sit there in amazement saying, hey, we're the party that is against censorship and book burning. The right wing that's always gone in for that kind of thing. And it doesn't do any good. I mean, it is just, you got to give them the brass balls award.
Well, Molly Ivins, thank you for spending some time with us. How's the weather down there in Texas?
Beautiful, thank you.
Well, it's been beautiful speaking
thank
with you.
And
I really enjoyed it, y'all.
Thank you.
And we are going to visit our friends in South Africa. Ken and I had an enormously satisfying opportunity to go to the Conference on Global Unionism, which was presented by Cornell University's new Global Labor Institute. And there we spoke with the General Secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, KUSATU, General Secretary Vavi.
Certainly, solidarity played a large part in defeating apartheid in South Africa and the ascension to the government of the ANC. What are the similarities and the differences in the programs now between the ANC and KUSATU? What's the solidarity like?
Very, very strong, and in particular in this period. You remember that we have just had a great campaign for the re-election of the ANC into government. We participated very effectively. We plowed lots of resources, and we increased the majority to 70% because we still convinced that the ANC and the KUSATU and the SACP should continue to have a stronger and deeper relationship. We convinced that the project of transforming South Africa will not succeed if we allow a permanent split. Yes, there has been difficulties, and I think that there will always be difficulties in that relationship because it's a relationship between an independent trade union movement that is absolutely robust and that raises the issues affecting its members very, very sharply. And sometimes that doesn't go very well with some in the government led by the ANC. And so there will always be difficulties. There were great difficulties in 2001 and 2002. When we challenged very effectively the privatization program, which we felt was absolutely hostile and was not going to serve the interest of our members. And so there were tensions around that particular time. But we're not forgetting the basic point that it was that tripartite alliance that brought South Africa its freedom and that it must be nurtured, it must be molded into a formidable force that we can use to deepen transformation, to challenge the power of the ruling elite in South Africa, which is white capital to ensure that we discipline it to play its role in terms of addressing the legacy of apartheid, unemployment, inequalities, poverty, and all those ills that we inherited from the apartheid. So that's basically the case in the South African politics. Sometimes the relationships are good, it's very great now, but sometimes they are fraught with tensions, and I think that's how a much more principled relationship should be. In 1999, there were about 3 days of initial strikes. The demands were and the struggles were about improving the conditions of work for the public servants. The demands were for better pay, for improved working conditions, for restructuring that is going to ensure increased levels of employment for critical areas in the public service. We're experiencing huge shortages in relation to doctors and nurses. That leads into a huge burden being placed on nurses and doctors and the general hospital and public sector workers. The situation now is those issues were part of the struggles that led to the 700,000 plus workers participating in that 1 day strike. That was one of the biggest struggles of workers employed by the government in the past 10 years. You remember, the situation now is that the government was forced to revise its offer and the unions are still in consultation with members as to whether they should accept it. And that's where the thing is now. It appears to be good in terms of the wage settlement, but it is not good at all because it delays benefit to medical aid and housing for many, many low-paid workers by 6 months. And I think that is, in that context, it cannot be regarded as a victory. I don't know what workers are going to say because the public sector unions are consulting with them. Whether they will accept it or whether they will not accept it, it will depend on them, because then if they accept it, it means that the strike is over. If they're not accepting it, it will mean that the unions must now mobilize for a much more protracted strike action.
Not too long ago, we had an opportunity to talk to famed musician Yuma Sakila, who was rather pessimistic about what he termed the increasing polarization in terms of the distribution of wealth. How severe is, and is it growing, the disparity of poverty for the working class in South Africa?
Yuma Sakila is one of the greatest South Africans. I know it. He has made an unbelievable contribution to not just the struggle to maintain our culture, but also to ensure that that culture plays a very important role in the broader campaign to make our people aware of the various difficulties that they have, whether politically and socially. He is correct in terms of analyzing the situation of what has been happening in relation to the economic development. We have seen greater levels of disparities, and I must say, unfortunately, those inequalities have deepened in the first 10 years of democracy, and the income of labor have been falling. In fall is now at its lowest, in fact, since the 1980s. And the share of the labor's income of the GDP has been falling. The inequalities are beginning to take a new form, a class form. Before, we knew that we have basically two forms of inequalities, where the group of white were in the minority in the society enjoying most of the wealth, and overwhelmingly black people were in the bottom of everything, in particular socially and economically. Unfortunately, we have seen in the past 10 years a phenomenal growth of the middle class in South Africa, including within the black population. So the sum of the black people, few as they will be in comparison, are beginning to have their lives absolutely changing to the better and making an interesting dimension in terms of inequalities, no longer just based just on race, but beginning to take a pure class dimension. And I think that he's right to register a concern that if we're going to continue with the path where inequalities are deepening, and where the incomes for labor are falling, and where the general in the society, there will be such disparities that will make the case for apartheid look like a Sunday picnic, surely that will lead to problems in the future. But we remain very, very hopeful about the future. We're doing the best we can to put pressure on capital and to put pressure on the state and to ensure that there is development in the country that is going to ensure that we employ strategies that will put us into a new growth path of ensuring that there's better employment opportunities for the employed, there's a better creation, the economy is put in a path where it will create quality jobs that will make an important contribution to end poverty in the country.
Well, you make the job easy for me. What are some of those strategies?
I'm convinced, and that's COSATU is convinced, that unless we are deliberate in restructuring the formal economy in the country, away from just an export-orientated economy towards an economy whose main focus will be meeting the basic needs of our people, that will make a big contribution towards ensuring that we have access to housing, to better education. There's a big shortages of housing that is going to ensure that we have cheap access to blanks, to bricks, to cement, and those types of things that will help us develop a proper housing infrastructure, an economy that is going to ensure that it develops, it helps development of the broader infrastructure, sewerages, better streets in the townships, and creating a better and more tolerable living conditions is what I think that we are trying to strive at. We believe that without confronting the power of white capital in South Africa today and restructuring that economy and ensuring that we have an active industrial strategy that is going to address these huge disparities and inequalities that we inherited from apartheid, then we will all be doomed, because then we will have to rely on the few exports based on the exploitation of the raw materials, and which will come to an end at some point, and then will the entire future of the country will go into the tubes. And we are quite determined to learn from the mistakes of the African continent, ensure that we have a much more active state that is going to drive development, that will discipline capital to play a much more positive role, that is going to put the country into a path of job creation, of addressing inequities that exist in the society.
What are the South-South relationships? What are the relationships of COSATU to building the organization of the working class on the African continent?
We have pretty stronger relationship with other trade union movements elsewhere in the South. We understand the imperative of ensuring that we strengthen the voice of workers in the South, and in the context of globalization that have led to huge income inequalities between the countries in the North and countries in the South. And that's why we have a very special and strong relationship, African trade union movements as well as Latin American movements in CUT of Brazil and in KCT of Korea. And that's why we're part of a greater movement to strengthen what we call the South Initiative on Globalization and Trade Union Rights, or SIGTU. And we have been working with the Australian Council of Trade Unions and with unions in Malaysia who have been banned and chased out of the country, in Indonesia and broader Asian countries. We have been trying to knit those movements together. We understand that this is going to be a long and difficult journey, but it's a journey that we think that we need to pursue, because we do believe on the need to strengthen the voice of workers in the South. But I must emphasize, we're not strengthening that voice of the South workers in competition or in opposition to the workers in the North. We do understand that workers and solidarity should know boundaries. The South workers on their own have no capacity whatsoever to effectively deal with the challenges brought about by globalization of our economies. We require solidarity and continued interaction with our brothers and sisters and comrades in the North, just like we believe that they are also in a very, very weak and vulnerable situation if they don't have an extended solidarity and relationships with trade unions in the South. So in that particular case, the relationship between the South and the North trade unions is absolutely the fundamental issue and goal that we should all pursue, but understanding that we at the same time require a very, very strong and independent voice from the South workers.
Workers in the United States, of course, are focused at this point upon the elections. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about the elections, but from the standpoint of South Africa and other underdeveloped countries, what would a Bush victory mean? What would a Kerry victory mean?
Well, we know Bush, what it will mean, more than we will know even what the situation we will face under the leadership of Kerry. We know the past 4 years have been absolutely a disaster for the world. We know that the insecurity, including from these crazy groups of terrorists, have become even more dire in the past 4 years, precisely because of the leadership style of President George W. Bush. We believe that the world will be a better place without George Bush in the leadership of the United States of America. We believe that what he has succeeded to do has been to dislodge the moral leadership position that the USA have always occupied over many, many years under the previous administration. The issue, for example, of Iraq, the fact that you went there under the pretext of looking for the weapons of mass destruction, and the fact that he's unable to find them and then shifting the goalpost into something else, have led to a situation where almost every other country believes that you can use any pretext, including a peg of lies, and to attack them. And that's the insecurity situation and feelings we have in most of the African countries, and I believe in most of the developing countries. And it has been a very, very difficult 4 years, and I believe that from our point of view, it will be in the best interest of the world peace if George W. Bush was not going to be re-elected into this very position of strategic importance in the globalization of today in terms of leadership of the United States of America.
Just like to thank you very much, and again, it's quite an honor to have you with us and to express certainly solidarity from the U.S. working class with our sisters and brothers in South Africa.
All we can do is to wish the workers of America the best of luck. We believe that the greatest challenge they face is to ensure that they put into the White House someone else who is going to have a much more moral authority to speak and build a real coalition against the greatest enemy of the world today, which is poverty and inequalities, and not the red herring of everything else. And we can only wish the American workers and the trade unions and all the freedom-loving Americans the best of luck in their endeavor to ensure that there is a proper democracy in this country too.
You Masekela, one of the great, great songs, and one of the great South African musicians. The song is Stimula. And if you'd like to contact Building Bridges, your community and labor report, Mimi, M-I-M-I, at buildingbridgesonline.org. We'd love to hear from you. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Good night, Mimi.
Good night, Ken. Hey, baby, but this is all by my life.